The Biological Jew by Eustace Mullins, Part 3. Lepage notes throughout his definitive studies of the parasite-host relationship that the host's defence against the parasite is always of an activist or a reactionary nature, such as cattle switching their tails, fish taking evasive action in sudden unpredictable twists and turns, and other wild actions which they hope will dislodge the parasite. During the 5,000 years that history has recorded the presence of the biological parasite in civilized communities, we cannot find a single shred of evidence that the host people has ever treated the parasite phenomenon in any but an activist manner, an unthinking involuntary action to dislodge the parasite. The host instinctively reacts against the presence of the parasite because it knows it will suffer in an injury form, this strange creature with its differing life cycle and goals. This is why the Jews always call those who oppose them reactionaries, that is, those who react against the presence of the parasite. Consequently, one of the major tasks of the parasite is to seek out all potential reactionaries among the host people and eliminate them. Because of this blind, unthinking reaction, which seldom is effective in ridding the host of the parasite, Lepage says, quote, "The basic essential of any campaign against a parasitic animal is a thorough knowledge of every phase of its life history and also of its relationships with all the hosts with which it can live. We need to know all the hosts because some of them may be reservoir hosts, maintaining sources of the parasites which can then infect man. With this knowledge, we can select for and attack the weakest points in the life history and biology of the parasitic animal." Close quote. Research and education, then, are the tools which are needed to counterattack against the evil influence of the parasite. Above all, we must avoid blind, instinctive reaction, since the parasite has long since learned how to anticipate and control such reactions, and even to use them for its own advantage. Lepage points out that, quote, "host and parasitic animal must always be considered together, because the parasitic animal is, like all other living things, intimately related throughout its existence to its environment. The fact that environment is, for a part or whole of its life, the surface or interior of another animal does not absolve the parasitologist from the biologist's practice of considering animal and environment together as a whole. A second objective is the demonstration that some species of parasitic animals are among the most powerful enemies of man and his civilization." Close quote. The parasite's concern with his environment sheds light upon one of the most important intellectual developments of modern man, the Enlightenment, that revolutionary force which has spearheaded the growing control of the parasite over the host. The pre-Enlightenment centuries of human thought considered man's environment as a secondary consideration because of faith in powers of the individual and the belief that the individual could triumph over his environment. After the sudden importance given to such French intellectuals as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, man was no longer considered as important as his environment. All at once, our leading thinkers decided that environment was the most important thing in life, and indeed it is, to the parasite, whose environment is the host which feeds him. But to the host, who is making his own way in life, environment is not the primary factor in his development, but to the parasite, environment is everything. all socialist thinkers and the various schools of sociological thought which have crept out of this development place primary importance upon man's environment rather than upon his powers to use that environment and to create a life for himself as he achieves his life's goals. When we understand the theory of the parasite, we are able to understand, for the first time, the entire modern socialist school of thought, because we can recognize it for what it is, the environmental psychology which the parasite has developed around his own life cycle. As such, it negates all of the host's thought, goals, and culture. Lepage urges us to remember that the parasite is among the most powerful enemies of man and his civilization. Here again he seems on the verge of going into the Jewish problem, but he shies away from applying his theories to the problems of human sociology. Certainly he could not have been referring to parasitic viruses or to the blood-sucking mosquitoes, for even if they hindered the building of the Panama Canal, they cannot be said to have caused the collapse of any human civilization. What could he mean? But the biological parasite which has infested man's civilization since the beginning of recorded history, and which has brought about the downfall of one empire after another, perhaps that is why he urges us to select, for attack, the weakest points in the life history and the biology of the parasitic animal.
Tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
During the 20th century, man has begun to concern himself with the problem of the collapse of world cultures, great empires which rise to their zenith and then mysteriously decline. We know why they rise. They grow because a people finds itself with a mission, or because it develops techniques for mastering its surroundings. A people takes advantage of favourable conditions because they have the will to carry out their mission. During the period when the people are able to channel their energies constructively, a nation grows amazingly in size and power in a geometric ratio. Then, suddenly, it begins to sicken and die. One example was Elizabethan England, which had expelled the Jews. When Oliver Cromwell brought back the Jews, the English people lost their sense of direction. And although their momentum was still sufficient to carry them on an upward course through the Victorian period, today we find that their aristocracy has been dispossessed, and their assets, although greatly reduced, are administered by aliens. Two scholars have formulated theories, developed through many years of study, to explain this process of the downfall of nations. The first, Oswald Spengler, was a German scholar of unique power and energy. He compiled interlocking records of every known civilization and carried on intricate comparative studies, which today could only be done by an electronic computer. So complex was his mastery of conjunctive of interweaving factors. Spengler concluded that a civilization is a body like any other, which is subject to the laws which govern natural bodies. He saw that a civilization had its birth stage, a young and vigorous stage, and an old age, which left it weak and prey to its enemies. In proposing this biological pattern for civilizations, Spengler was on the right track. Nor was he insensitive to the fact that civilizations develop internal problems which function like a fatal disease. Only on one point did he seem to be blind, the concept of the parasite. This is not too strange, for Spengler was greatly concerned with the finer aspects of human culture, the greatest achievements of man, his art, his music, his poetry, and his architecture. Of course, a scholar of this elevated turn of mind did not wish to concern himself with degenerative things which creep and entwine themselves about the reproductive and the excretory organs of man, those parasitic organisms which cause discomfort, disease, and death. A second explorer of this ground was Arnold Toynbee, a Donish Englishman. He was equally reluctant to face the omnipresent and distasteful fact of the biological Jew. He embarked upon a vast study of civilization, which covered essentially the same ground as Spengler, and added little to Spengler's findings. His sole original contribution was a theory which immediately became popular with the intellectual lightweights of the time, since it conformed to their own prejudices. It was cast in the accepted pseudo-sociological jargon which university nitwits employ to bemuse their students and each other. Civilizations fall, declared Toynbee, because of a failure of nerve at some point in its development. A civilization which lives by a system of challenge and response fails to respond to some challenge and goes down before it. Now this could refer to the biological Jew, since the parasite is a challenge to the continued threat of the host. However, it is a challenge which no Gentile host has ever been prepared to meet. It is a germ which is best defeated by inoculation or by personal cleanliness and careful attention to matters of health. Spengler's history of the decline and fall of civilizations could not be upheld because it did not take into consideration the obvious fact that few, if any, civilizations had died of old age. Nearly all of them had been murdered in one way or another, but Spengler was too preoccupied with the fine arts to become interested in the problems of crime and disease. Toynbee, on the other hand, could not be the detective in this case because he had lived most of his life on a subsidy from the criminal classes. His years of study had been financed by generous grants from the Royal Institute of International Affairs, one of a network of organizations which had been set up by international Jewish bankers as useful pawns in their operations. The sister organization of the RIIA in the United States is the Council on Foreign Relations, which I was the first to uncover as the principal power-holding company of the parasitic establishment in this country. In the first edition of Mullins on the Federal Reserve in 1952, a biographical note on the back cover announced that I was completing a sequel to the Federal Reserve book, which would be an expose of the Council on Foreign Relations. This was the first time that any American nationalist had ever publicly called attention to this organization. A few months later, a New York Jew via Hungary, Dr. Emmanuel Josephson, rushed into print with a book on the Council on Foreign Relations, which attempted to show that it was an instrument of Gentiles, such as the Rockefellers, and not a front for the parasitic Jewish community. I visited him, and we talked for 7 hours. It was quite obvious that he knew everything that I knew about the Council on Foreign Relations, whose offices were only a few doors from his home, and it was also obvious that he had placed a different interpretation on his findings. Just as Emmanuel Josephson refused to face the facts about the Council on Foreign Relations, so Arnold Toynbee, living on comfortable grants from the Rothschild family, found no evidence of parasitical weakenings of civilizations in his vast work, A Study of History, by Arnold Toynbee. Instead, Toynbee superficially studied the nerve patterns of cultures and the stimuli which affected them, without once mentioning the most vicious enemy of the nervous system, the parasite. When Toynbee says that a civilization failed to respond to a challenge, he asks us to believe that a man who is standing on a street corner and who is knocked down from behind by a runaway truck has failed to respond to a challenge. The fact is that he has been killed. Has Toynbee ever heard of biology? Has he ever heard of parasites? We find no evidence of it in his encyclopedic studies. Does he have any inkling that civilizations allow foreign bodies to settle in their midst, to flourish and operate without supervision and control, no matter how pernicious their influence may be? How could Toynbee spend 20 years in the study of ancient civilizations without knowing that the Jews opened the gates of Babylon to the Persian invaders, without knowing how the Jews brought Rome to its knees, without knowing how the Jews subjected Egypt to a terrible dictatorship for 300 years until the Egyptians rose and drove them out? Only a great intellectual pervert in the pay of the parasites could conceal such information after having uncovered it. A comparable deed would be Pasteur destroying the records of his rabies vaccine after discovering it, or Jenner concealing the formula for his smallpox remedy. I'll just interject here. I'll take issue with that point, where Mullins believes that the Jews subjected Egypt to a dictatorship for 300 years. In the New Testament, the Jews deny ever being in bondage in Egypt, so they deny that they were the Israelites that were in bondage. And the Old Testament makes it clear that Joseph won back the lands of Egypt for the Pharaoh, which meant that he won back the lands of Egypt from the Canaanites for the Egyptian people. And this was a white Pharaoh. And it also makes it clear in the Old Testament that after that time, a Pharaoh came to power that knew not Joseph. And this was a non-white Pharaoh. And they were the ones that subjected Joseph's people to terrible hardships. They threw their babies to the crocodiles and enslaved them. And they were enslaved for quite some time before they finally left. I think it's quite clear that this people that were enslaved by Egypt were not the Jews of Jesus' time, because they clearly said that they were not, that they were enslaved by Egypt. And they clearly weren't the Jews of today's time either, because today's Jews are descended from the Jews of Jesus' time and the Khazars. So I would take issue with that. He may not be speaking about that, but I suspect that he is, because that is the majority view, is that the Jews were enslaved by the Egyptians, despite the fact that they deny that in the New Testament. And also, if you actually read the Old Testament, Joseph was good to the Egyptians. He won their lands back and he saved the empire from starvation. If it wasn't for Joseph, then there would have been no Egyptian empire. It would have died out. They would have all starved due to the famine. Back to Eustace Mullins. A study of the biological parasite reveals a pattern, a set of characteristic and interweaving facts of nature. 1. The parasite prefers a healthy organism as a feeding ground. 2. The parasite's life cycle depends upon its finding a host upon which it can feed. 3. A healthy organism, which is invaded by a parasitic organism, is inevitably injured and often dies from the evil effect of the parasitic presence. Most often, the parasite causes the host to lose its sense of direction, so that it becomes helpless and is unable to defend itself against its exterior enemies. This pattern embraces a set of factors which have been common to every great civilization, which has suddenly sickened and died. Was Mr. Toynbee, in his decades of concentrated study, unable to discern a single one of them? Apparently the answer is yes. we see a state of affairs in which a people has built, through its own efforts, a great empire, whose ships trade with far-off lands, whose armies are invincible. This people is strong, self-confident, and aware of their virtues. Why should they fear a few shabby, furtive aliens who have drifted in from unknown places and who establish themselves in the heart of the city so unobtrusively that it seems they have always been there? These aliens are willing to do anything. They perform any sort of distasteful task which the natives feel is beneath them. The aliens traffic in the bodies of girls, set up gambling dens, clear in stolen goods, lend money, establish houses in which one can perform every imaginable type of sexual degeneracy, and provide assassins for hire. In a short time, the aliens know every secret of the people's leaders, and they have established holds over them. The colony of aliens multiplies rapidly, and soon a once healthy people finds itself helpless, because their native virtues of strength, courage, and honour, which have made them great, are of no avail against the newcomers. The host does not understand the parasite, which is like a creature from another planet, because they do not have the same goals, nor do they respond to the same stimuli as the host people. They even seem to have different nerve patterns. As the pernicious influence grows, the army is demoralized, the native leaders are murdered or exiled, and the wealth of the nation swiftly passes into the hands of the aliens. The people are plundered of everything, and most of all, their self-respect. No member of a host people is allowed to preserve his self-respect or his privacy once the parasite has taken command. One morning, the ships of a rival nation appear in the harbour. In exchange for certain guarantees, the parasites welcome them. The host people does not resist, and an empire is gone. Now, this process is not a typical life pattern of a culture a la Spengler. Neither is it a challenge and response a la Toynbee. The host people could have repelled any other attack by an armed invader, but they could not fight against the onset of a furtive parasite and the inevitable decay which he brought with him, a disease which affected and paralyzed the entire organism of the people. The theory of the biological parasite explains for the first time the fall of Egypt, of Babylon, of Rome, of Persia, and of England. A prosperous, healthy people allows a foreign body to establish itself in their midst. The foreign body paralyzes and destroys them. This new concept of history brings both Spengler and Toynbee up to date. It also offers a civilization, for the first time, an opportunity to escape the fate of its predecessors. The serious student may find himself appalled by the more repulsive aspects of the study of the biological parasite. He finds that one type of fish in the South Seas has a long tapering body, and that it enters the rear of larger fish and feeds upon the feces within. Man is plagued by a tapeworm, which enters his body, hooks onto the large intestine with a hook, which he has developed solely for that purpose, and begins to absorb the nourishment from the food eaten by the man. Various forms of lice secrete themselves around the reproductive or the excretory organs of man and cause him extreme discomfort. Parasites find that the waste matter excreted by humans is a fertile breeding ground for them, because the human is a higher form of life which uses large quantities of food and excretes much of it with the food values intact. These excretions provide rich food for the parasite, but his attachment to it poses health problems for humans. Consequently, humans try to dispose of their waste matter so that it will not become a breeding ground for various obnoxious forms of parasites. The parasite considers this to be very cruel and unjust, and he endeavours by any means to reach it. If he endangers the life of the human, then so what? A fly on a manure pile is not concerned as to whether he poses a threat to the health of humans. It follows that the parasite, which has established itself upon the Gentile host, does not care how much it injures the host. Its only goal is to lead a parasitic life at the expense of the host, and its natural objectives are usually the reproductive and the excretory organs. Throughout history, we find the Jew entwined about the reproductive organs of the Gentile host like a parasitic vine which is slowly strangling a healthy tree. The Jew has always functioned best as a panderer, a pornographer, a master of prostitution, an apostle of sexual perversion, an enemy of the prevailing sexual standards and prohibitions of the Gentile community. When the title of America's Largest Pornographer was bestowed by police investigators, who was the holder of the title? One Irving Claw of New York, who carried on a vast business in nude photographs and other items of the trade. Other Jews of great intellectual aspirations have become writers, transforming our literature into dreary recitals of sexual acts and making it impossible to publish anything which fails to conform to their standards of depravity. Other intellectual Jews have created a new profession, one so characteristic of them that it is known everywhere as a Jewish profession. This is the profession of psychiatry, an outgrowth of the parasite's obsession with the reproductory and excretory habits of the host. What is the basis of the science of psychiatry, as it has been formulated by its Jewish founder and patron saint, Sigmund Freud? The basis of psychiatry is the anal complex, the theory that an obsession with the anus is the principal influence on our emotional development. Many millions of words have been written on this subject, despite its distasteful connotations, and learned speeches about the anal compulsion are delivered by scholars before the world's learned bodies of distinguished men. With the anal complex setting the tasteful tone of the parasite's obsessions, the Jew has gone on to develop other theories about the processes of human excretion. The most important influence in the modern school of progressive education is the science of toilet training. While much of modern art is based and easily recognisable in its origins upon the faeces complex or the handling of its stool by the preschool child, other important contributions of Jewish psychiatric thought, which have been hailed as major intellectual developments of tremendous depth and scope, are too filthy to be repeated here. When one contemplates the spectacle of a great hall filled with well-dressed and well-educated men and women from many countries who are listening intently and occasionally applauding a little Jew in a tuxedo who is delivering a learned dissertation upon the anal and excretory habits of mankind, we realize yet another aspect of the Jew. No matter what he does, the Jew is so fantastic that he becomes a comic figure. When the former Premier of France, Mende France, announced that his nation was surrendering the huge French investment in Vietnam to the communists, one hardly knew whether to laugh or cry. So comic was the bulging-eyed, black-jowled image of a rag merchant howling, "Uldragza!" through the streets. The poet, Ezra Pound, once observed to me that when he began to suggest to people that Jews were exercising undue power in the Gentile world, no one took him seriously, because everyone knew that Jews were only clowns. As usual, the Jew used this impression to fix his position upon the Gentile host, Charlie Chaplin, with his racially characteristic gestures, employed his typically obscene movements to be hailed as a great comic genius by the indefatigable international Jewish clique. He made millions of dollars by wagging his behind at the audience, scratching frantically at his buttocks, and exhibiting the usual run of the parasite's age-old preoccupations with the reproductive and the excretory organs. In his own right, Sigmund Freud is an even greater comedian than Charlie Chaplin, because the Freudian theories of human behaviour, as the great Gentile psychologist Carl Jung reminded us, are based upon the biological parasite's enormous misconceptions of the nature of his Gentile host, and Freud's theories are even more comical than the gyrations of Charlie Chaplin. Yet we laugh at Chaplin and study the theories of Freud seriously.